Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 30th, 2003. Today's session is entitled The Importance of Reason, Wisdom. Session 3 of Healing the World, Ideas and Perspectives from Luther and the Lutheran Tradition, presented by Daryl Jodoc, number JOD 2003-03. Let's listen in.
I'm from Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota. And this week, the series of things that I've been trying to talk about is the theme Healing the World, and then some ideas and perspectives from Luther and the Lutheran tradition as the background of that. The particular topic for today is the importance of reason or wisdom. This is unusual to have so much competition from children outside. So if you can't hear me, either move up or hold your hand up or something so I can talk louder. The importance of reason or wisdom is the theme for today. My concern here, as far as healing the world is concerned, is that an affirmation of reason and wisdom are very important in terms of a sense of agency for people in the world. That is, those persons in this room who have been influenced by the Lutheran tradition, and I know you may not all have been, but those who have been recognize that there's often a strong emphasis on sin and sinfulness and the need for forgiveness, that every act that we do has a sinful dimension to it. All of those are very important themes. But if they're taken in isolation, they can lead to a kind of despair about doing anything helpful for the world. They can lead to a kind of isolation, that my private relationship with God is the center and focus and the most important thing, and the rest of it is only places where I fail or don't succeed or can't accomplish something. Now, it seems to me that there are other themes in Lutheran tradition which counteract that and give a person a sense of agency. Now, what I mean by a sense of agency is simply that I can make some kind of difference in the world. I teach a course on the Holocaust and its relationship to theology, and one of the things that's observed by one of the books that we look at is that for those persons who turned out to be rescuers, that is, who risked their lives to help somebody that was going to be a victim of the Nazis, they often have been exposed to the same degree of prejudice as those bystanders who did nothing. But one of the differences between the persons who were rescuers and the persons who were bystanders was the persons who were rescuers had a sense of agency. They had a sense that they could make a difference somehow in the world. And yesterday I told a story about a little boy playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star on the piano and a concert pianist coming in and working that theme into a very beautiful piece. Well, I think that what happens for our relationship to the world is that we play our little Twinkle Twinkle Little Stars and God somehow makes it into a symphony because there's so much that surrounds it and informs it and amplifies it and so on. But unless we feel a sense of agency, we won't play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star even, right? We won't get that far either. So I think that a helpful thing to draw upon in Luther is his sense of the importance of reason or wisdom. So let's define some terms at the beginning. What I mean by reason, or what finds in Luther about reason, is really two different senses of the word. One sense of the word is simply the ability to discover information and think about it. It's the capacity that we have to learn and to think. That's reason. But there's a second possible definition, which is the ability that someone might think they have to find out about God by reason without reference to scripture and church teaching and the like. Now, that second sense of reason, of course, is one that Luther doesn't approve of. And so sometimes people run into expressions that Luther says about reason and they conclude that he's against it. That is, one runs into an expression such as Luther talking about that reason is the devil's whore. It's one of the famous images that he has of reason. Or one thinks about his explanation in the Small Catechism, I cannot by my own reason or strength believe in God or come to him. Well, that's the second sense of reason. He very much disagrees that reason itself, by itself, can get us very far in terms of understanding God. He believes that for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is that reason always serves some other purpose. It's never neutral. Reason is always helping me get to some place where I want to go with it. Some place that serves some kind of purpose. And as long as we're out of relationship with God, as long as we're living in a curved in upon ourselves sinful state, then reason serves to enhance myself. Right? And as long as I'm preoccupied with myself, reason's not going to get me to understand the other, to understand God. There is a second reason why he doesn't like that kind of reason, and that second sense of being able to discover God on one's own, is that he was influenced by the Occamist tradition. And I put two different spellings of it down on the right-hand side there. And as an Occamist, he was heir to one side of a debate that was occurring in the late Middle Ages. And that debate was over the role of reason with regard to God. The Occamist said that God can will whatever God wants. And God has such freedom that God can decide whatever God wants to do. God is loving, so God decides loving things to do, but God can decide whatever God wants to do. And so the only way to understand God is to look at what God has decided. And where do you look to find out what God has decided? You go to the scriptures, because that's the record of the decisions of God's relationship towards the world. The other side, the non-Occamist side, argued, no, reason is so important that God always decides what is reasonable. So if you can figure out in advance what is reasonable, you can know in advance what God will decide. The Occamist said, no, you can't do that, because that would make that would limit God's freedom and make God subservient to something else. Okay? So you can't predict what God will decide until you see the pattern of what God has actually decided. So because Luther was an Occamist, and he never stopped being an Occamist, he was on that side of the debate that God's freedom and God's will was such that God could freely decide whatever God did, and afterwards we'd see that it was reasonable. That's another reason why he didn't like this second definition of reason. We'll come back to reason in a minute, but wisdom is the ability to understand people, to understand community, that is people as groups of people, and to understand what benefits others. So wisdom is whatever we need to figure out what actually benefits a community or benefits my neighbor. And that means understanding people, it means understanding how things work, it means whether this will actually benefit or will subtly harm my neighbor. That's wisdom. And so let's start with those two and talk about them just a little bit. Luther gave a lot of importance to reason. We stop to think about it, and to wisdom. Let's just cite some examples of where it's important, places which you probably know about, but you probably haven't sort of thought about in this context. One of the places where Luther gave a lot of emphasis to reason and wisdom was when he gave advice to the princes and the rulers. At the end of a treatise that he writes on temporal authority, he stops and he gives advice to the princes and the rulers. And there are several different things that he says. But one of the things he says is that don't be too preoccupied with laws. Don't be too preoccupied with following a law exactly in every particular case when you're deciding, for example, how to punish somebody or what to do when somebody's done wrong. Because sometimes the punishment can do more damage if it's perceived as being unjust or whatever, than it can do good. So he says, when you're dealing with deciding tough cases, use your reason, use your wisdom. Think about Solomon. Solomon, remember that case, that famous case when two women come to him claiming that their one child belongs to, you know, I'm the mother, no, I'm the mother, and Solomon decides to cut the child in two, and the real mother protests, and he decides which one it is. Well, he says, no lawyer could ever have told him that. No legislature could have written a law that would say that was the way to do it. He said, you had to use reason or wisdom to do that. Now, that's one place. Another place where he uses appeals to reason or wisdom is with regard to how we treat other people. Luther does not put out any exhaustive lists of do's and don'ts. The essence of ethics for him really comes down to a very simple principle. Simple to enunciate, not simple to practice. A very simple principle, which is whatever benefits your neighbor is good, period. Whatever harms your neighbor is bad, period. That's it. That's the ethical principle. Now, yes, one can get some guidance from the scriptures in terms of how to understand what benefits one's neighbor and so on. But there's never a list of do's and don'ts. Why is there never a list of do's and don'ts? Because he wants you to use your reason or your wisdom to understand what it is that one's neighbors need. Now, there's some faults in this little example that we could criticize, but for the moment, just sort of let it be. And that is, he would say, you know, if a man loves a woman loves a man, you don't have to have somebody else coming in to tell them how to treat the other person. I mean, maybe at some point you do, but it was his example. You don't really need that, because if they genuinely love the other person, they're going to listen to what the other person wants and needs and do what that person wants and needs. So use your reason, use your wisdom to figure out what it is that actually benefits the community or actually benefits another human being. Still another place where he appeals to reason or to wisdom is when it comes to constructing a government. His contemporary, John Calvin, went through the Old Testament and came up with what he considered to be the ideal pattern for how to organize a government. Luther refused to do that. He said, no, when it comes to government, use your reason. Figure out what actually you need to have to get the welfare of the people served and to serve justice and to protect human dignity and so on. You know, whatever structure will work at this particular time in this particular place, at this particular community with this particular group of people is okay. You know, use your reason. Figure out what works in terms of politics, etc. Another place where he appeals to wisdom is when he writes to the city councils of Germany recommending that they all establish public schools, schools at public expense, for, amazing at the time, both young men and young women, he says specifically. And in order to justify this, he writes a nice little essay in which he says, this is 1524, he says, well, one of the reasons why we should have schools is to enable people to read the scriptures, to participate more fully in Christian worship and so on. But even if that were not so, even if there were no souls in human beings, it still would be important to establish schools. It still would be important to establish schools because it's by studying what people have done in the past and what's worked and what hasn't worked, that they will get the wisdom and the good sense to be able to know how to run a community or how to run a household. And then he says, but somebody might protest, well, what, can't parents teach them that? And he said, well, no. What happens when you allow parents to do it is that they get a kind of veneer of respectability, but underneath they're, quote, the same old blockheads, unquote. So you need teachers and you need schools. So at public expense, please establish, he said to all city councils, establish schools and libraries, and do this, because along with bridges and other things that are important for a community, having an educated citizenry is part of the health and well-being of a good community, and one needs that. So, again, an appeal to reason or to wisdom and its importance as far as he's concerned. My appeal here is that if we are to be, in some small sense, agents of healing the world, in some small way, making a difference, having a sense of agency, it seems to me that what we're called upon is to use our reason and our wisdom, and to do whatever we can to listen to what people actually need, whatever we can to sort out what does, in fact, benefit our people around us, and to some extent, to whatever way we can, to be agents of accomplishing that in the world. And that if we were to interpret our Christianity in such a way as to not prize or not value that particular ability that we have to reason and to think, then it would be hard to see how it might heal the world in as full or complete sense as it can if one is there. Now let me add one other last thing, and then we'll open this up for conversation and your reactions and so on. Critical thinking. One of the things that's a kind of code word in colleges these days is critical thinking. And everybody goes around saying, we ought to have more critical thinking, and we ought to have more courses that teach critical thinking, and we'll have requirements in critical thinking, and so on. It's a kind of in word, in phrase. And I want to talk about not because of that, even though I live and teach at a college and I'm exposed to it, but for a slightly different reason. By the way, the problem I have with when it becomes a fad is that it gets disconnected from the reason why it's important. And coming at this from the direction, Lutheran influenced direction, the reason critical thinking is important is because we need it in order to serve the neighbor. That is, it is a facet of what we need in order to serve the neighbor. And if critical thinking becomes an end in itself, then it distracts us from the task of serving the neighbor. Or put it another way, critical thinking is important for discerning the truth, the truth is important for serving our neighbor. And if somehow critical thinking becomes an end in itself rather than an avenue to the truth, it's diverted us, it's become a distraction instead. Back to Luther. One of the interesting things about Luther in his particular time and day was that Luther went back and studied the history of the church. That was not a typical thing for theologians to do in his day. In fact, when he was preparing for his significant debates in 1518, for example, where he records that he's gone back and studied the history of this, or he's gone back and studied the history of that, topics that would come up in the debate. Now, one of the things, the reasons he does this is that he has this very clear sense that the church is a community, and that any community grows and changes over time, and any community adapts to different situations and so on. So the church, like any community, has had a history, and some things that are true now were not always true about it. So he goes to investigate, well, you know, was it true that the church always had
celibate priests. I know it turns out that it didn't always have celibate priests, as it had them everywhere. Well, no, it turns out that the Eastern Orthodox Church, the Eastern Church, had married priests, and so it wasn't true everywhere. And that little piece of information freed him to be able to think about alternatives. Freed him, knowing that it hadn't always been the same, he could think about, well, how ought it to be today? Should it be the way that it's been in recent history, or should we rethink that in terms of what actually serves to heal the world and what actually serves the gospel and proclamation of the gospel? To get some sort of contemporary image of this, think about the novel 1984 that was popular several years ago. The main character in 1984, his job is to sit and change all the newspapers so they say exactly what the government says is true today. And so nobody can go back and look at a newspaper and find out that things have ever been different. And the reason the government doesn't want anybody to find out everything's been different is that then they'll get the idea that reform is possible. They don't want anybody to think about reform. So the main character in 1984 sits in his cubicle and rewrites all the newspapers so that they say exactly what people are saying today. The point then is that critical thinking can open us for reform, but the point that I want to make, and that's one of the reasons why Luther was interested in it, but the point I want to make is that critical thinking is also very, very important in terms of determining what actually does serve the neighbor or not. And critical thinking, therefore, is the ability to scrutinize a statement or a proposal and to discover flaws in its data, its logic, or its wisdom. If I can cite a contemporary example of how critical thinking is very important when dealing with public policy, which one of the things we have to deal with Christians, is that I was surprised to read prior to the invasion of Iraq that 42% of the people in the United States thought that Iraq was supporting, that Saddam Hussein was supporting Al-Qaeda. Well, that evidences a lack of critical thinking in public, because there was no sound evidence whatsoever of any kind of connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. If one looked into the reasons why Saddam Hussein was doing what he was doing, an entirely different agenda from what Al-Qaeda was doing. There was no overlap of interests between them. And so there was an absence of having thought about something critically when 42% of the people in the United States just grabbed on to something that politicians had hinted at without ever even saying explicitly, perhaps with one exception of before the United Nations. So it seems to me that we do need to have critical thinking in order to discern what it is that actually does help a neighbor. Because only when we have the truth can we really genuinely help the neighbor. Now, at the beginning of the week, I said that there were two central propositions in Luther that one had to understand, out of which everything else flowed. And one of them is the sense of God's gospeling acceptance of us as human beings, that we are unfree with regard to the divine relationship, and that it's God's grace that creates this relationship and adopts us without any merit of our own. And the other is the active sense of God in the world. Now, the capacity for critical thinking is not unrelated to the first of those principles. There's a man by the name of John Hout, who is a Roman Catholic theologian that teaches at Georgetown University. And in a little book that he wrote, How to Think About God, or What is God? How to Think About the Divine. What is God? How to Think About the Divine. He makes a very interesting point.
He says that most human beings have a built-in desire to know the truth. But what happens to human beings is that our desire for truth gets overwhelmed by our desire for acceptance. And so we get distracted from seeking the truth by our need to be accepted by those around us, so that if everybody else around us is thinking a particular way, it's just much easier to do that than to seek the truth. Or if somebody criticizes us for seeking the truth or being so preoccupied with discovering something or investigating something, we'll tend to choose acceptance rather than to pursue the truth. And then he says that with regard to our ultimate status in the world, it therefore is crucial that the truth, namely God, is also unconditional love. Because only if God has unconditional love are we freed from the need for acceptance, and therefore free to search for the truth. As long as we don't see that God is unconditional acceptance, we will be swept off the track of searching for the truth by our need for acceptance. So it seems to me that that in a Lutheran approach to things, adoption of God, so far as God is concerned, you are my child no matter what, is the basis upon which we are set free to use our reason, to use our wisdom, to engage in critical thinking, so that we can find out as much as we need to know about the community, about nature, about other people, about the world, such that we can genuinely decide to do those things that actually benefit. Recognizing that it might only be twinkle, twinkle, little star, not a whole symphony, part of some larger community, but still an important contribution to healing the world. So let's see what kinds of reactions or comments you might have.
Yeah. Two questions. I'm assuming that John Calvin was the whatever that was.
A non-optimist.
Yeah.
Okay, yes, that's perfect.
And the second one was regarding Newton's thing on gonna follow the law, so the essay he wrote. For us here, the idea of, do we assume that we see justice and we will not follow unjust law? I could see that may be an enormous problem for Luther. And how do we as Lutherans respond to that? How do we support laws that we don't agree with? Do we think there are unjust enough of a problem then as a problem now?
Yeah, as far as he was concerned, with regard to a law that one considered to be unjust, his recommendation is, of course, that one work to change it. And he was particularly concerned that one work to change something was unjust towards somebody else, that one become an advocate for the justice of another group. And as far as injustice that we ourselves endure, he would recommend, because he was so concerned about not undermining public authority, he would recommend that we simply submit to it and not revolt and so on. So there could be reason to engage in all kinds of public activity so long as we're doing it on behalf of justice to somebody else. As part. I'm talking about him now, I'm not talking about me, I'm talking about him. And he did think that justice was important. When, for example, there was the threat of a revolt from the peasants at the time were having a very difficult time because the economy was changing from a barter economy to a moneyed economy. And in the past, peasants had been able to contribute a part of their produce or part of their labor to the landlords. And all of a sudden, things were changing so that the landlords were asking for money. And it was very difficult for peasants to get access to the money that they needed in order to pay the rent to the landlord. And so they were very unhappy and very upset. And they were threatening to revolt. And somebody sent him 12 articles of sort of what in the 1960s we would say our demands. That's not the vocabulary they used, but that's what the 1960s would have used. And he wrote back and he said, many of these things you're asking for are just. And so he recommended to the princes, be sure you sit down and negotiate. Don't think you're so high and mighty that you can't negotiate with peasants. Sit down and negotiate. And you peasants, make sure you sit down and negotiate. And you come up with something that's just and reasonable. Well, unfortunately, of course, it didn't happen. The peasants did revolt. The princes went in with a very vicious put down of the revolt. But he was concerned to be a part of justice seeking by himself and on the part of Christians. He was always sending Christians out into the community. The community needs a mayor, become a mayor. If the community needs a hangman, become a hangman. The community needs a garbage collector, become a garbage collector. I mean, whatever the community needs is a vocation that's appropriate for a Christian to be involved. One other component. And the other component is, he says, some of the laws Christians don't need. I mean, if you were a true Christian, now, there are very few true Christians around. Probably none, okay? But if you were a true Christian, this is the kind of idealized category he's using, you wouldn't need laws. Because if you genuinely loved everybody, well, you'd do everything the law asks you to do anyway. Right? You wouldn't be stealing from your neighbor, you wouldn't be murdering your neighbor, you wouldn't be moving your boundary over there, you wouldn't be cheating your neighbor, etc., all the things the law concerns about. But even if you were an ideal Christian, you should obey the law. And why should you obey the law? Because the community needs it. And you are called to be doing what the community needs rather than what you need as an individual. Well, those are lots of comments, but I'm not sure.
No, that's true.
Yeah, okay, yes.
Yeah. Interested in pursuing the relationship of faith and reason.
Yeah.
Do people who don't have faith, are they capable of exercising reason to the extent of finding truth? I mean, the last comment you made about the connection between having faith in the gospel and the ability to ultimately find truth says it would argue there's a clear connection between faith and reason. To what extent would Luther or the Lutheran tradition say that those apart from the faith can exercise reason in a trustworthy way?
Yeah. Well, let's simply talk about Luther himself.
Okay.
Luther himself gave quite a bit of, would affirm the role of reason quite a bit when it came to questions other than one's relationship to or understanding of God. So he would say, for example, that remember now, he's living in a kind of Cold War and real war situation between the Turks and Christians in Europe. The Turks are coming up, Muslim Turks are coming up, and are as close as Vienna, Austria, and winning battles as close as that to Germany. And so there's all of this anxiety about the threat, real threat. It's a little like living in the 1950s in the United States and the Soviet Union, and doing drills of hiding under the desks. I mean, it's real, but it's perceived as a big threat. So even in that setting, he says, many Muslim rulers and Turkish princes are very fine princes. I'd rather live under a wise Turkish prince than under a foolish Christian one.
So there was a recognition of the capacity of people to use their reason and wisdom in a productive way apart from Christian gospel. You would also talk about parents. Right? Look, the people on the other side of this Cold War and hot war, Muslim parents love their children. Gifts are given to them through it. They've used their wisdom to give, you know, appropriate, to parent appropriately. And that's a sign of that. Governments are organized in a way that help, are helpful. So he would give a lot of weight to the positive role that reason could play. But at some point, even in one's relationship to another person in ethics, it would be sabotaged by a lack of faith. When push really came to shove, as far as he was concerned, without the gospel, one would get diverted into serving oneself or protecting oneself or whatever, instead of being able to listen to the point where it threatens myself, or to be able to serve to the point where my own self-interest seems to be. And for him, the Christian message would really break through that, or was, at least potentially could break through that, so I could do something which served others even at cost to myself. And he didn't see that happening, typically at least, without that gospel. Is that making sense? Yeah.
Doesn't there come a point in some situations where if you really follow Christian beliefs, laws can't be followed? I'm thinking of Nazi Germany.
Yes.
And, you know, what happened during the civil rights movement, where laws are clearly, you know, segregation or
yes.
That type of thing.
Yes, yes. Let me say two things in response to that. One is that on Monday, John Marty talked about nonviolence and the way in which nonviolence is not passive,
mm-hmm.
right? It takes a great deal of independence and courage and so on and commitment to be nonviolent and to protest. And Luther would say that when a government does an unjust thing, that at least one's first response is to do that kind of active, or some people call it passive resistance, but they mean by passive, nonviolent resistance, okay? Luther endorsed that. Somebody comes along and wants to collect Bibles, that's an unjust law. Don't turn your Bibles in. That was an instance that came up. On the other hand, if they come into your house and take it, don't resist, he said. And don't take up the sword against the ruler of that. The second thing to say is that if one takes Luther's principles and applies them differently from Luther himself, right? You with me? You take his principles, but you don't necessarily take his conclusions. It seems to me that that one could build a case for open revolt. One could build a case for open revolt when other people in the society are being so mistreated, that it is better to revolt than to go along with it. And of course, that's the point that Bonhoeffer reached in Nazi Germany. He was convinced that if he participated in the plot to assassinate Hitler, it would mean millions of lives that would be saved. One can think of a situation such as of one of the persons in South America in the 1970s talked about a government that was so ignoring the welfare of the people that only one out of five infants ever made it to 6 years old, and they didn't make it for preventable reasons. There was the needless death of four out of five infants or children. If one could change that government in such a way as to stop this needless death of four out of five infants, I think on Lutheran principles, one could justify a revolt. So not only is nonviolent
resistance endorsed, but it's conceivable that there could be a case in which one would actually seek to change the government or something. Now, Luther might turn over the grave in his grave to say this, because Luther was so concerned about order in society that he didn't want it to be disrupted. Now, he lived at a time where they were right on the edge of chaos. And order was an important gift. We live in a time when governments are capable of producing too much order. A totalitarian government is something Luther couldn't have envisioned in his day. You know, the Nazi government, with all of its totalitarian potential, that's a different circumstance that he couldn't even imagine in his day, I don't think. And so that's why I think we need to sometimes come to different conclusions than he came to, because the circumstances are different, even if we use the same principles that we use. Does that make any sense to you?
Question regarding liberation theology.
Yeah.
How would Luther respond to that? That's a real.
Yeah, there's actually, I hate it when people do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. The nicest thing is to refer you to a book in that regard. And there's a book by Altman, which is precisely on Luther and liberation theology. And the point that Altman makes is similar to what I'm saying, that at certain points, Luther's principles would endorse what's occurring there. At certain points, it would have reservations about what's occurring. So there is possibility of agreement there, at least up to the point.
You have a question?
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Is there any chance that Luther's position on submission to civil authority was the price he paid for the protection he needed?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Possible, but I think not likely. And the reason I think it's not likely is that he disobeyed his ruler. I mentioned another day that when his ruler kidnapped him, Frederick the Wise, and put him in the Wartburg for his own protection, Luther sneaked out and went back to Wittenberg, dressed as a knight. That made Frederick the Wise quite upset, because he didn't want him back there. He could protect him as long as he was at the Wartburg, but he didn't know how to protect him once he was back in Wittenberg, and certainly not on the way from the Wartburg castle back to Wittenberg. And there are a variety of occasions under which Luther simply won't do what the prince wants him to do. And Spalatin, his good friend, is always negotiating between Luther and the prince to see if he can work out some kind of an accommodation where Frederick the Wise and Luther could somehow do the same thing and not go like this at each other. So, maybe, but that would be the qualification.
Surely, if he had changed his position or modified his position on that point, he would have lost that protection.
That's an interesting question. You mean on the question of sort of open revolt? That one?
Yes.
Yeah. Perhaps so.
All of us only have so much time and so much intellect and stuff like that. So what about big questions like the Middle East, for example, or South America, where you hear conflicting sides and things like that, but who of us has time to research all the different options? I mean, some of us do, but I guess the rest of us have to maybe listen to people we trust or something. How do you look at that? How would Luther look at that?
Well, it's certainly true that we can't investigate everything we need to investigate, and at some point we have to trust, discern on the basis of the trustworthiness of a source or a person or an advisor or a commentator or whatever.
someone that we can trust, and that's true. But it seems to me that most of the decisions that we're making are decisions about things that are closer to us than the Middle East. Now, I don't mean that we shouldn't be concerned about the Middle East, but most of the things that we're deciding about are closer than that. And what is true for us in a post-Holocaust era is that we have to be much more attentive to the consequences of our actions than we were before. And we really do have an extra burden to find out what the consequences of our actions are. What I mean by that is that if you were living in the Holocaust and you were an engineer driving a train, and you thought of your vocation as only being a good engineer, which has been sometimes the interpretation of what vocation means, you could have been a good engineer getting your trains there on time and contributed to the Holocaust if you didn't notice who you were hauling, right? You could have been a good production worker on a Cyclone B factory if you didn't ask where all of this extra production was going or how it was being used. You could contribute to the Holocaust, etc., etc., etc. That means that we have to be scrupulous about where we invest our money, what are the consequences of that. I think, for example, of the woman whose name I can't remember right now, who came to speak at Gustavus, who had spent a year up in a tree in California. She talked about the corporation that owned the land. The previous corporation had been a family operation that took only those trees that could be sustained. And they took only the number that it could be regrowth, the, you know, before, and they would just cycle part of it. Then a new corporation came in, a larger corporation, and they decided to cut everything in sight and maximize their profits. Well, investing in that second corporation, because the return was good, would have the effect of being destructive of our environment in an unreasonably destructive way. How do we know that? We really have to go to work to find that out, right? That's not something that people come around that are selling stocks to tell us. We have to go beyond the normal things that normal people do in our society in order to exercise our vocation at that point. And we have to think about wherever we work, what's the effect of whatever we produce? You know, I'm producing widgets. Are these widgets harmful or helpful to human beings in the way they're used? And we have some responsibility for that.
I guess as you were saying that, I was thinking, and it includes one of the words up there, the serenity prayer we love, you know, grant the serenity to accept things that cannot change, the courage to change things that can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Exactly. Yes.
Part of the problem in this country is that we are so comfortable.
Yes.
And it's so easy to not do anything about some of the injustices in the world. How do you help people get to a point where they see beyond their own comfort and work towards
That's an excellent question. Okay. All these questions are good, but that one's really central. The only little thing that I'm trying to do is to prevent people from interpreting their Christianity in such a way as to reinforce that. Right? That's the level of little teeny twinkle twinkle little star that I'm playing. Beyond that, it seems to me that that experience is really, really, really important. I said to one of my colleagues once, many years ago, he was in the education department, we were sitting having coffee in a coffee shop, that many of the young people that were coming to our college in the East were from the suburbs of New York and Philadelphia. And I said, I'd just like to take the whole group into Appalachia or Jersey City or Pine Ridge Reservation or someplace so that there could be questions that would be
aroused such that there'd be some motive to ask questions and to seek education and to investigate and to be motivated to learn something different from what they expected to learn. I suspect that we need to do something like that with people in our congregations as well. That somehow or another we have to have find some kind of experiences that break this open a little bit so that a person gets moved to think about the plight of others. Lutheran World Relief trip to South America or Africa might be a good one. In our college, we have an excellent program that takes people to India. They spend a whole semester in India, and they come back with so many questions. They come back with a great deal of difficulty adjusting to being back here again. Lots and lots of questions. One of my colleagues took a group to El Salvador. They experienced the hospitality of people in El Salvador that had almost nothing. They were there while the earthquake occurred, and they saw the people trying to respond to that. It broke it open for them. Other people might have better ideas than I do about that, other than the affirming the importance of what you're talking about. I'm not sure what else I can say.
Just to second that idea, in a suburban congregation, the experience of those who go to staff a homeless shelter have a different view than the majority of the congregation, who just can't seem to find how to do that at all. It is just different if you've been there.
There's a book in our bookstore, actually. I think I saw it. It's called A Common Fire. It's written by four people who surveyed 100 people in the United States who were, quote, living lives of commitment. And what that means is they were doing something to serve the larger community and saw themselves serving the larger community. And they went through the profiles of these 100 people to try to find out what they had in common. And one of the things that they had not anticipated, that they were surprised to discover, was that a common feature was what they called a constructive engagement with otherness. That some place where they had seen the humanity of somebody on the other side of a barrier. For one woman, for example, it was going into a prison. And she signed up for a social action committee at a church and found out that the social action committee was not sitting deciding what somebody else should do, but it was to go do it yourself. And there was a prison just down the road, and she went to visit the prison and over the course of time discovered that these were genuine human beings on the other side of the bars and organized this huge program over the years that brings in counselors and teachers and so on to help not only give a better life while they're there, but to give a potential for a better life after they get out. Well, there was a barrier there. She'd never thought of the people on the other side of a prison bar as being common human with them. The persons that go to India discover that these poor people are also human. And it's the sense of the linkage with that which provides the vocation, the calling, to get outside of our comfort zone into something else and other factors that influence. But that's just one that was surprising to them. So thinking about that as, how could we accomplish that in one's own community might be at least one place to start. How are we doing? What's the time?
21:22.
All right, so we got a little more time. Good.
Darrell, that's a big question. We've got a lot of big questions. but if Luther's sense of what you did after using your reason was to do the thing that was good for the neighbor,
Yeah. You're
the ruler, and you think what is good for the, even thinking about maybe the most neighbors, is to support the owners of businesses so they hire more people, mm-hmm. and that'll be good for the community. Another person looks at it and says, no, I think what we ought to do is collect taxes from more people
and support the community through those taxes. Did he have some guidelines for how you decide which way to go? Because I think we're, you know, all of our leaders are faced with those kinds of questions every day. You can serve these neighbors, or you can serve those neighbors.
There is one guideline that's important, but it may not solve the question, may not be enough. And that guideline, and this comes back to your question about liberation theology, that guideline is that God is at work on the side of building up the poor and of breaking down the powerful and the mighty. It's this very profound and significant commentary on the Magnificat, that is Mary's statement when she finds out in Luke 1 that she's going to be the mother of Jesus, and it talks about God and the kind of God that gives these kind of gifts to the lowly, that God feeds the hungry, sends the well-fed away empty-handed, lifts up the lowly, breaks down the powerful. But God, this is the kind of activity that God is doing behind the scenes in the world. And therefore, that one would have to give priority under this principle of Luther's, that if God is giving priority to building up those that are weak and those that are hungry and so on, one would have to give priority to that if one was following Luther's principles. But then, as to exactly how you accomplish that, then Luther puts you back on reason and wisdom. And there, you know, one of the very nice models that if we want to think about public policy, a very nice model comes not from the Lutheran tradition, but from the Roman Catholic tradition. When they wrote a policy statement, which was actually a little booklet in the 1980s, Economic Justice for All, they had hearing after hearing after hearing and listened to all sorts of, quote, experts on all sorts of issues and of economics and land stewardship and role of labor unions and all of those sorts of things, and then put the draft together and then subjected it to critique and then put the draft together again. That model of really taking seriously the expertise of as many people as they could possibly get in contact with and taking the job seriously of writing this document, that's a kind of model for us of public policy. I think we do need to evoke a public discussion about that, because as individuals we probably don't have enough to do it on our own. We need to have a public discussion of it. The ELCA has sometimes followed that in social statements, but when it came to the ELCA statement Sustainable Livelihood for All. Does somebody remember that title?
Mm-hmm. That's pretty close.
I think that's right.
Yeah. It was to me a disappointment. Not that what it said isn't good, but it just didn't dig deeply enough into things, it seemed to me. And Roman Catholic bishops with a longer statement in the 1980s had done a better job.
Statement. That statement on economic life that they made.
Yeah.
I wear Nikes. I disapprove of Nike's policy. And I'll probably go buy some more Nikes because they're really comfortable. And I live with this guilt. And I don't know where to go with it a lot of times. I'll go buy a bargain at a discount house and wonder at what price I gave this bargain. But I do buy. Sometimes bigger than I can go home and figure out.
Yeah, at some point, we can't manage to do everything about everything.
It's overwhelming.
It's overwhelming. And therefore, it seems to me that we have to, begin with smaller things.
not small things, beginning with specific things. They may not be small, but with specific things. You know, deciding that we're going to buy pre-traded coffee in order to give the coffee growers a break, or we're going to buy an oriental rug to make sure it's not made by children, or, you know, keep, you know, buying from as much as possible from small local business owners and farmers and so on, rather than the giant corporations and so on. We have to decide, I think, if we're going to invest in social choice options rather than non-social choice options. At least it helps with regard to stock, et cetera. We have to do a series of things that we know are not enough, but keep expanding the list. One of the features that they discovered about the rescue, another feature they discovered about the rescuers in the Holocaust period, was that every one of them had a history of caregiving. This was not the first time they'd responded. It had become such a habit that when a new reason to respond came along, they said, well, here is a person in need, what else could I do? Which is not a very satisfying answer when you've got a microphone in your face and somebody saying, why didn't you do it? But it reflected the fact that it had become such a habit, such a consistent practice, that it was able to be expanded and carried over into something that was really genuinely risky to the point where it could have cost them their lives and their families' lives, as well as the lives of people that they were saving if they had been found. But they're very nonchalant about it, very matter of fact.
Yeah, I bet you're thinking of that movie about the French.
The Weapons of the Spirit, about La Chambon. Yeah. That's one place.
They were just simple.
5,000 simple villagers saved 5,000 people in southeastern France. Quite a remarkable story. If you get a chance to look at it, it's a movie called Weapons of the Spirit. Pierre Sauvage was born in the village as a Jewish child to people who were being hidden there, and he went back to make the documentary, and it's quite a good documentary about Washington.
Pianist is another one.
But that's fiction, of course. Yeah, I mean, it's based on somebody,
right.
But it's fictionalized.
Right.
Yeah, this is a documentary. Pianist is very good. Very good movie. I'd recommend
but
it.
But it has the principles that
yes.
You're talking about.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, now how are we doing time-wise? It's time to quit?
Yeah, it's about 1:15.
Thank you very much. Thanks.